it's not just about teaching them to fly away from you, but teaching them to be their own voice, to ask for what they need, because being independent isn't about not needing things or not needing help. It's about being able to ask for help and support when you need them.
Hi, this is Danae. I'm the founder of Simple Families. Simple Families is an online community for parents who are seeking a simpler, more intentional life. In this show, we focus on minimalism with kids, positive parenting, family wellness, and decreasing the mental load. My perspectives are based in my firsthand experience raising kids, but also rooted in my PhD in child development. So you're going to hear conversations that are based in research, but more importantly, real life. Thanks for joining us. That voice that you heard at the beginning of this episode is Sunny Jane, whose pronouns are they, them. Sunny is my guest today, and they are a lived experience educator. I will say that, hands down, they have been my favorite guest of the year. I have learned so much from them, and I am continuing to learn. I spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the parent experience, what it feels like to be in the shoes of a parent. And honestly, that's where I spend a lot of my time thinking, because I am a parent, and that's the role that I have right now. Sunny is not a parent, but is an adult with a lived experience of neurodiversity. In their work, they have given me a better understanding of what it feels like to be a child who is othered, as they call it. But aside from helping us have a better understanding of differences within childhood and how that feels for our kids, I've also looked to them for advice on how to have meaningful, authentic relationships with neurodiverse adults. In my chat with Sunny, I'm telling the story of how I was in kind of an uncomfortable interaction online with an autistic woman, and it helped me to realize pretty quickly that I have a lot to learn, and maybe you do too. If we're striving to make this world more inclusive and more understanding, then we need to expand our support beyond just the kids, but also to the adults too. So a little bit about Sunny. Sunny is from Southern Australia. They are queer, agender, physically disabled, autistic, has ADHD, and in their work provides lived experience education, consulting, and advocacy services for neurodivergent individuals, mental health professionals, organizations, and services who are interested in learning more about the lived experience. How and why is the lived experience different? A lot of times we have professionals and maybe even parents talking about their experience with people who are autistic, or their experience with people who are bipolar, or their experience with people who are agender. Not often enough do we go to the source and actually ask those people themselves, those people with the lived experience, what it's like for them and what they need from us. Sunny and others who are doing similar work bring such a meaningful perspective to people like me who are professionals, who are sort of viewing this from the periphery. Again, this is hands down my favorite conversation this year, and I think everyone listening will take something away from it. And one thing in particular that I hope you take away is the desire to learn more, and especially learn from people with lived experiences. Without further ado, here's my chat with Sunny. Hi, Sunny. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell me a little bit about who you are and where you live. You're halfway across the world from me.
So I'm Sunny Jane. My pronouns are they, them, and I live in Australia. So South Australia, to be exact, on Kaurna land, otherwise known as Adelaide. And I'm a lived experience educator, advocate, and consultant. And I'm autistic with ADHD and various lived experience. And I'm really, I guess, really passionate about educating, you know, organizations, professionals, society on neurodivergency and like being autistic and ADHD and, you know, helping other people support neurodivergent people.
I love that. So I want for this conversation, please, and I hope you're probably very good at this, but correct me whenever I say something that could be said better, because I am trying to learn all the time. So feel free if I say something that you feel like doesn't feel comfortable to you, please let me know. Okay.
Of course. Thanks for that offer.
So a lived experience educator, can you tell us a little bit more about what that exactly is?
No, of course. So lived experience is basically, you know, having lived experience of a mental illness, of, you know, a diagnosis, or lived experience of autism and ADHD. It could also be, you know, lived experience of navigating the system or seeking out supports, or lived experience of being, you know, gender diverse or disabled. So I have a bit of lived experience, and what I do is I educate using lived experience rather than using it, using the knowledge or qualifications gained from a degree. So any education that I do is led from the perspective of lived experience.
I love that. So a lot of what I do on the podcast is really talking to parents, because that's my primary audience. But I do think that when I'm talking to parents, especially if I'm talking to parents who have neurodivergent kids, I'm really talking about the parent experience and kind of missing this lived experience piece. So you're not a parent, but you were a child, and I imagine you can speak pretty well to that lived experience.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I also just want to say that parents have their own lived experience. That's, you know, the lived experience of parenting that not everyone can claim. And I think as well, the lived experience of parenting a autistic or ADHD kid is different to lived experience of parenting a neurotypical child.
Yes. So have you ever heard of the book Far From the Tree?
Yes, I have. Not read it, but have heard of it.
Okay. I haven't read the whole thing. It's like 1,000 pages. It's huge, but it is essentially, it's a book by Andrew Solomon. I've talked about it a couple times on the podcast, but it's written to parents who have kids who fall far from the tree, who are developing and growing in ways that are different from the ways that parents identify. And I think it's written beautifully. It is dense, but it's written really beautifully. I highly recommend at least the first chapter to all parents. But that first chapter, you get a lot out of it. But one thing that it really makes me think of is the lived experience of kids who fall far from the tree, who are growing and developing with a very different life story than their parents, and how that impacts their connection to their family. Can you speak at all to how that has been part of your life?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, growing up, I had a number of brothers and sisters. So up until I was like 10, I had four, and then we added another two when I was a teenager. So I grew up with six brothers and sisters, and throughout my childhood and teenage years, I absolutely, you know, felt like the odd one out, you know, the one that wasn't included or couldn't relate, who was definitely treated differently because of who I am. And what happened, it meant my siblings kind of actually grew up believing, you know, certain things or saying things about me because of what they learned growing up. So it definitely, you know, felt like this othering, being neurodivergent amongst a family who, you know, didn't quite get autism and ADHD, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Were you diagnosed as a child?
Yes, I was actually. When I was about, started going through the process when I was about 7, and I think I ended up with the autism and ADHD about 8 or 9 or 10 early years before I was a teenager.
And what did your parents do? What were their next steps after your diagnosis?
A social skills group on a Tuesday night and medication, unfortunately. There was not a lot of education or resources or different types of support available when I was diagnosed 20 years ago as a kid. Medication was the route that was offered. That's the route I ended up going on for 11 years.
Okay. And the social skills groups, what was your experience with that? Were you there with other neurodiverse or neurodivergent people?
Yeah. It was a social skills group every Tuesday night with other autistic girls or AFABs, assigned females at birth, I should say. And we were all autistic, and we did different activities. I remember going, having a sleepover there one time, and it was basically like, you know, social socializing with other autistic people, attempting to learn skills. I don't actually remember much from my time there. However, I do remember another autistic person who loved horses, and I remember her talking to me a lot about horses. So the only thing I really learned from that social skills group was special interests are awesome.
Oh, I do love that. And I mean, have you found that developing that peer group has been a key part in helping you to thrive?
Back then, the autistic social skills group, it mostly made me feel a bit othered and like there was something wrong with me. Okay. Because that social skills group was predominantly, based on trying to, teach us neurotypical social skills. And so, I remember asking my mum one time why I was going, because I didn't understand why they thought the way I socialized was wrong or weird.
Yeah.
I thought, we all socialize pretty well, at least in that group.
Okay. So the reason that I reached out to you and I've kind of been pursuing learning more about lived experiences myself is, I'll tell you the story. So I was, This was an online story, and I think that is a key part of it. It's so hard to read. It's hard for neurotypical people to read social cues online. So I can imagine, what is your experience interacting with people online versus in person? Is one easier than the other for you?
Neither's easier. I think online can be easier because when you're online, you're more likely to have to clearly state your intentions because you're online. But in person, people don't state their intentions. So I think online is slightly easier because, you can take your time to analyze or figure things out. There's more specific communication. Words can be sometimes easier because they use full sentences. But either way, social cues hard.
Okay. Because I'm kind of imagining reading through, that makes sense. So you can read it. You can read it more than once to try to figure out if there is, if you need to read between the lines, which if you're in person, your people are expecting you to just kind of snap and do it.
Yep.
Okay. So I was in a Facebook group and I had been offering a resource. Someone was looking for a resource for services, and I offered a resource at a local university that we had used. And here in the US, university-based services are often free because the school can't charge for them. So I offered the service and said, well, here's a service through the university and it's free. And I was trying to be helpful to this person who was looking for services. And someone responded back in reply to my message, something along the lines of, I don't remember verbatim, but it was, well, Danae Barahona, nothing is free and other people are paying for your free services that you're taking advantage of. And and so that's how I felt. I was like, I definitely responded back with something snarky. And I was like, actually we made a donation because they can't charge you, but you can make a donation. And then I felt like I had to go into this long explanation about how I wasn't taking advantage of free stuff. And so I ended up clicking over onto her profile and it said that she had autism or she was autistic, which is better. What's the preferred?
I'm autistic.
Okay. So she's autistic. And then after you interact with someone on Facebook, you see that person kind of comes up, the algorithms prioritize. So I started seeing other interactions with her and other people and sort of similar dynamics where it felt a little bit rude. And I thought to myself, I was like, I think that I am putting neurotypical expectations on our conversation patterns and on the way that I'm viewing the way that she's interacting with me and with other people. Yeah. And like, how can I do better? How can I be more understanding and accommodating? And I realized that I just don't really know how to socialize and interact with people or with autistic people in the best possible way. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? What advice can you give to someone like me?
No, of course. It's actually a common problem that I experience like online as well, where, I'll be having a conversation on, my social media posts or on a Facebook group like yourself. And, you know, halfway through the conversation, it can end up with the other person labeling my tone of voice or, you know, assuming things that I'm saying that I'm not actually saying. And so I think, you know, two things that are really important is when interacting with autistic people, don't read between the lines. I like to say we say what we mean and we mean what we say.
Okay.
So if we haven't said it, then that's not what we mean.
Okay.
And another thing as well is that it's something that I experience a lot is getting labeled as, well, rude or blunt or passive aggressive when I'm using, like, you know, really straightforward short sentences. You know, I can it's interesting because if we don't use niceties or emojis or we don't, you know, layer our sentences in other sentences, we get labeled as direct, we get labeled as rude, passive aggressive when we're just using direct literal sentences.
Yeah. I think there's a bit of a gender piece in there. In my experience is that I find that when I'm interacting with women, there's more emojis and exclamation points and niceties, but with men, it seems more direct. Have you noticed that? Absolutely. I don't know what you're.
Yeah, no, okay. That's definitely true. You know, so I'm a gender myself, so neither man or woman, but I find myself being able to interact and communicate a lot more easier with men because they because it's straightforward conversation. There's no small talk. There's no hidden meanings behind sentences. There's no needing to fulfill niceties with emojis. I find it's a lot more straightforward to communicate with men purely because of, you know, that type of social conditioning that has resulted in that kind of communication.
Yeah. So what if this woman was a family member? What would you suggest that, what would be a desirable way, I guess, to interact? Like, would I tell her that she's being rude, or will I say that felt rude, or will I just kind of accommodate the fact that this is how she communicates and she socializes?
Well, one thing could be to, I guess, not label or assume someone's emotions or intent on the way they're communicating.
Okay.
So I find, you know, saying someone is being rude can often be an external observation rather than an accurate representation of their intent or their, you know, how they're feeling. The same as saying someone, it sounds like you're being angry. We're actually assuming what they're feeling when we don't know what they're feeling. So it's basically not making assumptions based on the way someone is typing or phrasing their sentences. I mean, unless they start throwing insults and, you know, using not nice words, then I think that's when we can, like, kind of go and, yeah, you're being rude. But I guess, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
That, you know, that's so interesting because I find that that comes up a lot in the parent-child relationship. I remember as a kid saying to my mom, stop yelling at me. And she's like, I'm not yelling. And I'm like, but you are yelling. And she's like, I'm not yelling. And it's all about perception, right? The person hearing it. I heard yelling, but she didn't feel yelling. And I get that with my kids sometimes too. Like, they'll say that I'm raising my voice and I'm like, I'm not raising my voice, but it is all in the way that, you know, the person hears it. It can feel different than it was intended.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, we can validate how, you know, especially in, like, those moments, like that Facebook group, for example, is like, you know, you might have felt uncomfortable in that. And, you know, those feelings are valid and we can validate those feelings without also labeling another person as well.
Yeah. I'm going to pause for a quick 1 minute word from today's sponsor. The sponsor for today is Native. One of my favorite parts of this time of the year is the food. I can never get enough of how amazing everything smells. And speaking of smells, I have to tell you about Native's awesome new holiday-inspired scented products. You may have heard me talk about their aluminum-free deodorant, but they are working to overhaul your entire hygiene routine with products that have simple ingredients like shea butter and coconut oil. There are plenty of classic scents, but I love that they're rotating in seasonal ones too. My favorite so far is the candy cane scented deodorant. And I think they'd make great stocking stuffers or gifts. So stay merry, happy, and fresh this holiday season. You'll love Native's limited time seasonal products as much as I do. Go to nativedeo.com/simple or use the promo code SIMPLE at checkout to get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/simple or use the promo code SIMPLE at checkout for 20% off your first order. All right, back to my chat with Sunny.
So that's really helpful. I'm kind of just like mentally processing this and thinking about future experiences. And I guess I think that online is such a hostile world. I don't know if that's your experience in Australia, but the US, like the political climate here, I think things have just, and with the pandemic, like it just feels, everything feels very threatening. And I think people are very guarded. Is that your experience too?
It's not mine. In Australia, we absolutely have a very different experience happening. And I think, you know, in the US, your people's, you know, feelings of, you know, feeling threatened and hostile is absolutely a response to what's going on. So, you know, it's absolutely valid that people are feeling that way because of, you know, the current climate and environment.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about socialization and what that looks like for you.
Looks like now or back then?
Well, what feels good to you, maybe I should say.
Most of my friends are actually all neurodivergent. They're either autistic or have ADHD, which has probably been the most life-changing for me and the most helpful in, you know, socializing in my social life.
Okay. And tell me, what does agender mean?
Agender is someone that basically has no association or relationship with gender. They don't feel a personal attachment to the concept of gender. So they kind of just can't relate.
Okay. I see. And have you felt that your whole life?
Yes, in a way. I definitely wouldn't have been able to label it like that. But I never really understood and was always, you know, I never understood the concept of gender and assigned gender roles, especially as like a teenager when, you know, I wanted to play with a lot of the toys my brothers wanted to play with and I didn't understand why I couldn't.
Yeah. Okay. So what, now you have a drop-in center. I've seen some videos of this. It looks incredible. Tell me a little bit about what a typical day there looks like and what your hopes are for that.
Yep. So we recently closed as we're moving to a bigger and better, like a huge location. But basically it's like a second home, a home away from home. And our new space is actually going to have a community garden, kitchen, board game room and art and craft room. And basically it's where people, you know, can drop in and hang out, you know, access tools and resources, explore their special interests, find communities, and, you know, just, you know, spend their time there and, you know, get all the benefits of, you know, the everyday things that we need that you can't always find, you know, in your life, like, you know, access to friends or, you know, for example, exploring special interests and hobbies and creative hobbies and creative like activities and that is so beneficial in many, many ways. But one, not everyone, you know, has access to that kind of space. And two, not everyone can also afford to, you know, go out and buy a whole brand new watercolor kit or, you know, clay, you know, set. And so basically having that kind of space where you can access those things is kind of like the everyday mental health support that people need. So it's kind of, yeah, like a home away from home, a drop-in space where anything and everything happens. I don't think there is a predictable day.
Yeah. You know, I was reading something that you wrote about independence versus collaboration. And I thought that it was just really eye-opening to me to think about. I mean, as a parent, it's just like all about like, how do you raise this kid to be independent in the world, right? Like, how do you give them wings so they can fly away from you? But you have a very different perspective on independence.
Yeah. You know, in saying that, one of, you know, it's not just about teaching them to fly away from you, but teaching them to be their own voice, to ask for what they need, because being independent isn't about not needing things or not needing help. It's about being able to ask for help and support when you need them. Mm. And that's why I like advocating and self-advocacy skills is the best thing that you can do for your child, is to teach your child how to ask for things that they need and how to ask for accommodations and how to, you know, look after their needs.
I feel like if I had like a mic drop sound, I would drop it right here, because I just feel like what you just said is, I think, valuable to everyone everywhere. You know, independence is not about not needing anyone. Independence is about knowing how to ask for what you need when you need it. And that is something I think everyone struggles with, especially moms, like people listening to this podcast. I think that is one big, huge struggle for moms who have a hard time asking for support too. So that really resonates with me.
Especially when, you know, there might not be the support or resources out there for moms. And especially when moms already have so much shit going on that, you know, having to find that help and ask for that help is like an extra barrier, an extra thing you have to do.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about advice that you would have, and I hate to put you on the spot here, but advice you have for parents raising kids to really be their authentic selves, especially raising neurodivergent kids to be their authentic selves. I mean, you'll probably have a million thoughts on it.
Yeah, I know, right? One of them would definitely be, don't hide the fact that they are autistic or have ADHD. Embrace that, acknowledge that, and obviously do not treat it like a deficit or a weakness. Treat it as a part of them. It's just a matter of fact. It's who they are. Another thing would be to allow, you know, your autistic and ADHD kids to connect with other autistic and ADHD kids. Finding that community is really, really important and validating. And connecting with other autistic kids actually allows them to, you know, learn skills and to, you know, learn the right type of skills and to develop, you know, self-esteem and identity and confidence. And also another thing would be to, you know, being autistic and ADHD is difficult, and we need a hell of a lot of accommodations and support and understanding. But there's also, we have major strengths and really cool things about us. And so embracing those and acknowledging those is a huge, really crucial part of our development. You know, my mum, if there's one thing she did right, is she really, really embraced the fact that I was like weird in a good way and unique. And she really taught that, you know, being normal, I'm putting air quotations marks right now, is like overrated. And so one thing that helped me is like when I was in my 20s, like I never thought that being weird was a bad thing. I thought being weird was always like the cool thing to do. So I never felt ashamed over being weird or quirky. And that made a big difference, because I was ashamed over other things.
Talk a little bit about masking and what that is and how that impacts you.
So masking is basically where we hide parts of ourselves, especially our autistic and ADHD parts of ourselves, to fit in and meet neurotypical standards. So for example, that can look like not stimming, you know, forcing ourselves to make eye contact, even when that's uncomfortable, you know, not saying things that we want to say, because that might be perceived as too weird. Not, you know, liking the things that we want to like, because they might be perceived differently. You know, I've actually, fun fact is, when I was in my early 20s, I actually kind of decided that I wasn't autistic with ADHD. So I actually learned to mask a lot. And it wasn't until I was about 27 that I was re-diagnosed in a way, and came to the realization that, oh yeah, no, I am autistic and have ADHD. And that's actually when I started learning to unmask a lot, and was kind of really crucial in my mental health.
Yeah. And the masking can play a huge, huge role in mental health challenges, right?
Oh, absolutely. A really good example is when I was a kid, every time I came home from school, that's when my meltdown started happening. Because in school, I was forced to mask, you know, all day. I had to deal with sensory overload. I had to, you know, pay attention. I had to focus for hours. I had to socialize. I had to, you know, sit still. And so when I came home from school, I was so tired of masking all day that, you know, that's when I kind of erupt like a kettle. And so that's something really important to understand that, yeah, if your kid comes home from school and, you know, they're a little bit wild or defiant, it's often because they have had a difficult time at school trying to mask and fit in.
Yeah. Now, and I know your age gender now, but you growing up, did you identified as female? And I had, from what I've read is that masking does impact females more so than males. Have you found that to be true?
Definitely. Okay. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way, so a lot of, you know, ADHD and autism criteria was based on, you know, the male presentation. And obviously females are already socialized differently. And so then not only do you have, you know, females are socialized differently, so the autistic and ADHD criteria is utterly wrong, but, you know, females are also more likely to mask because of our social conditioning. You know, we have to be quieter, you know, we can't, I actually have a hard time with, because I'm agender and probably because I'm also autistic, I actually have a hard time separating autism into like female and male thoughts. Does that make sense?
No.
I have a hard
tell
time
me more.
I have a hard time explaining the difference. So for
how
example,
it impacts differently, you mean?
Yeah, because okay. It all impacts me.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I mean, and I think about like the traditional, I guess, when you think about male, female, males tend to externalize more of their feelings and females tend to internalize them, you know, hold them all in, which I think may
so it's so
be
interesting
related to that masking.
I absolutely did both. I would internalize a lot, which I led to like a lot of shame, guilt, self-harm, self-esteem. But then I also externalized a lot, which is probably what led to me getting a diagnosis as a child, even though I was female. And, you know, traditionally you go undiagnosed. My symptoms matched the male presentation of autism and ADHD. That's how I ended up with diagnosis. So I find a good thing that might be really cool to look at is the idea of a female autism phenotype is actually inaccurate because it does, you know, assign gender roles to autism. So I think, yeah, there's this misconception that there is a female type of autism, if that makes sense.
Interesting. So I'm kind of all over the board here because I just have a lot of random thoughts for you. So I'm sorry, I keep jumping around. So I'm a clinical social worker by training, which is a therapist. And then my PhD is in child development. So, and I actually used to do ABA pre-PhD, and I was pursuing ABA as a career. And then I ended up working under a leader who left me with all sorts of bad feels about ABA and moved in a different direction. And that's when I went back to do my PhD. But thinking back to early in my career, when I worked more as a traditional mental health therapist, I worked with a lot of kids and a lot of families with relationship challenges. And I didn't know anything about neurodivergence. I mean, other than like the ABA approach, which is a very different approach. But now that I think about doing therapy with people with relational challenges, I just think about how many people with relationship quote unquote challenges are maybe just neurodiverse people. And how does therapy work for these people that are constantly feeling like they're not showing up in the way they need to show up in relationships when the reality is maybe they need to form different types of relationships. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
No, that absolutely makes sense. And like in total agreement here. And I think that's when it comes down to is, you know, changing what they think about relationships and what they need to be. Especially, you know, because there are these certain black and white expectations or neurotypical expectations and on that are put onto relationships.
Yeah.
So changing what those mean and also teaching, you know, those the individuals in those relationships the skills needed. You know, for example, for a neurotypical, that would mean understanding neurodivergent communication. And then for, you know, the neurodivergent person, that would mean, you know, teaching them skills to communicate in a way that supports them. Don't teach them neurotypical skills, but teach them skills that help them advocate for themselves, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. And I just think, how often do mental health issues arise out of undiagnosed neurodivergence or out of neurodivergence that hasn't been properly supported?
Oh, absolutely. I think that is very, very common because, you know, when you go unsupported or undiagnosed, you know, you question that there's something wrong with you, that why are you different? You know, why can't you do the things that other people can do? It creates all these questions, you know, and yeah. Self-doubt and shame and guilt. So, you know, having that awareness that, you know, you might be autistic or ADHD is more helpful than people realize.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about sensory overload. What does that look like? What does that feel like?
So sensory overload, absolutely, you know, it feels different for everyone. And the feelings of sensory overload can be, you know, physical, emotional, like, you know, internal. So for example, for me, it's when I start getting really, really irritable. That's one of my signs, is when my patience starts getting lower, when little things start bothering me, like the sound of my partner eating chips, where in any other day, I don't mind who eats food around me. Yeah. On days where, you know, I'm experiencing sensory overload, it's the little sounds. On days I'm experiencing sensory overload, I can pick up the sound of my TV and electronics. I don't want anyone to be close to me. And it's, you know, when my insides feel different. So I have really poor interception. So I have trouble picking up on like the physical feelings of sensory overload. I only know the other signs.
Yeah. So some days you may be bothered by the crunching of the chips, and then other days it doesn't bother you at all, depending on kind of what your baseline is.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that right there is a huge piece of education that the people who love you need to know, right? That some days you cannot eat chips around Sunny, and maybe you just need to like be okay with that. Right.
And I think that's exactly what it is, you know, I have a baseline, and that baseline changes. My sensory needs often change. And so it's kind of accommodating that, going with the flow, and also, you know, offering what I need in those times. So being able to recognize what's going on and either being able to offer a helping hand or kind of step back when I need it.
Yeah. And I think to some degree, we all have those different baselines that impact our reactions, right? You know, if you had a long day at work, whatever it was, like, you're going to be more sensitive to certain things than others. Yeah. And our kids too. And I think sometimes we don't give kids the space to do that and to feel that. Like, we can get upset with kids for getting upset. And that, I don't know, the idea that kids aren't allowed to get upset or they need discipline for getting upset and having tantrums, that feels really uncomfortable, you know, because, you know, I've talked about on the podcast a lot. Like, we all have tantrums. Right. Yes. And everyone of every age has tantrums, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, when it comes to autistic and ADHD kids, you know, they're not so much tantrums, but they are meltdowns. And meltdowns are definitely different from tantrums. And I think that's something really important to remember. Because I know when I was a kid, I was labeled as having tantrums. And so therefore I was kind of labeled as being a naughty kid. Whereas, you know, they were meltdowns, and that's a bit different.
Meltdowns related to the sensory overload?
Meltdowns, okay. Can be due to a number of things, but yeah, sensory overload, overwhelmness with tasks, lots of things going on, change of plans. But meltdowns are something that specifically happens for autistic and ADHDers.
Okay. So the last thing that I wanted to ask you about was something I've been thinking a lot about. So we have a lot of different books in our house, just different books about all different types of people, kids' books. And we have books about ADHD and about autism and about dyslexia and all sorts of things. But I read them to my kids, and I almost wonder if it's kind of hard to explain here. So my fear is that I'm going to read this book about dyslexia, and it's like this, they learn sort of this baseline. Dyslexia is kids who have a harder time learning how to read. And are they going to go around sort of as they get older, kind of with this very small understanding, and sort of label kids that they meet, label their friends, this kid can't sit still, this kid must have ADHD. And is there value in really teaching kids who have not been diagnosed about all these diagnoses? Like, why can't we just teach them about neurodivergence as a concept? I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
It's interesting. All right. Two answers. One, I think if we teach someone about, someone with ADHD about ADHD, they're not going to go around, they're not automatically going to go around labeling everyone as ADHD. And if the people they do call out their ADHD, they probably are. but on the other side of things, I think you are right, is teaching neurodivergence is probably more beneficial. And this does not mean denying the concept of ADHD or being like that, not using ADHD or autistic, but it's not viewing them as a list of symptoms or traits, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Just like the fear of your kid showing up at the playground as like a mini neuropsychologist, because they've learned a little bit about these diagnoses, thinking that they can, and that hasn't happened to me, but like after reading these books, I do kind of have that fear that my kids may like start like talking about this and like labeling kids, and it feels kind of inappropriate. And I've looked for books. I'm like, I just want to teach my kids about different kinds of brains and people being wired differently, and that it doesn't matter what the labels are, but like just see the person. And I cannot find that child, that kid's book that I would like to find. So maybe you need to write that kid's book, Sunny.
I feel like there has got to be some awesome kids books like that.
I haven't found one. If you find one, will you please send it to me?
The only one that I can think of that might be good is The World Needs More Purple People.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. Okay. I'm going to look that up. The World Needs More Purple People.
It's just something that I can think of that I'm not actually sure what it's like. So that is a good question. Yeah. However, the only other one I can think of is Different Like Me.
I'll put some links to these in the show notes. Think on that for me, Sunny. And if you come up with any more, I'd love to share some.
No, absolutely. Because, I think you're totally right in wanting to normalize neurodiversity and normalize, differences and strengths and everything without, I guess, in a way, using pathologizing language.
Yeah. And there has to be like that, I don't know. And I don't think that kids, especially young kids, need to be in the business of really knowing and talking about the labels if the labels don't belong to them. I mean, surely if they belong to a friend and the friend wants to talk about it and share it, but I don't know, I haven't felt super comfortable reading those books to my kids for that reason. I'm just not sure. I don't know. What do you think about young kids learning about different diagnoses?
Well, if we don't treat them as diagnoses and we treat them as, neurodivergence or differences, okay, then I think we absolutely should, teach kids the same way that we should teach kids about other genders, because that other kids are always going to, you know, interact with other children and other people. And we don't know if they're autistic or ADHD or, you know, gender diverse, if we want to follow my example. And so we teach those kids so, you know, they have understanding and compassion and they don't view it through a bad lens. Because, look, as a kid, you know, people saw different as bad. Yeah. And so if we can teach children and normalize, you know, ADHD or autism as differences and they're not bad, then, you know, it means, you know, they're not going to grow up with those types of beliefs or views.
Yeah, I love that. And I hope that the world has come a long way since you were a child. Do you feel like there has been a lot of progress?
Oh, absolutely. Like a massive amount of progress. How I thought about autism and ADHD when I was a kid is vastly different to how I think about autism and ADHD as an adult, because the education and the awareness has changed a lot. And I think as well, there's a lot more awareness and education and slightly more support and resources for parents. My mum, you know, didn't have any access to support and resources, which changed, you know, my childhood a lot, if it was different and I had access to other things. And yeah. So I think we've definitely come a long way where, you know, neurodivergent kids and individuals have better opportunities, and so do parents.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Sunny. It was so great chatting with you. And I would love if you have any other resources to share. So we can find you online at The Lived Experience Educator on Instagram, right?
Yes. And that's my website as well.
Okay. And I'll put that in the show notes too. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
No, thank you so much. It was a great opportunity.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Sunny. If you want to get in touch with them, go to simplefamilies.com/episode288, and I'll put the links there. You'll also find the links to the books that they mentioned. That's simplefamilies.com/episode288. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you have a chance, please leave a rating or review for the podcast. That helps this show to reach more people. I appreciate it. Have a good one.